It's the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. As families prepare for the start of school, this year marks the 50th anniversary of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows parents to withdraw their kids from public schools after eighth grade for religious reasons. The High Court decision in 1972 stemmed from Old Order Amish members advocating for the right in what became a landmark case, Wisconsin v. Yoder. What do you wonder about this history and about parents' rights in education? Email ideas at WPR.org. We have two guests ready to talk about this and take your questions. We'll start with Marcy Hamilton, professor at the University of Pennsylvania and founder and CEO of Child USA, a think tank dedicated to protecting kids and preventing abuse. Marcy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Wisconsin v. Yoder decided in the 1970s. You've said this case is a landmark case for extreme religious freedom. How so?
This case opened the door for religious families to argue they don't have to fully educate their children. And part of what happened is the court trusted the Amish to be law-abiding. It would all be good for society. But it has opened the door to organizations like the fundamentalist Mormons, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, to not educate their children even close to what the standards need to be.
How is that possible that the Supreme Court, you know, set out some regulations and there are things that parents are supposed to follow, but that isn't actually happening in practice in what you're seeing?
Well, unfortunately, what the Supreme Court said is that if a religious group or parents have a good enough reason, that reason, if it's religious, is more important to than educating our children. And so it opened the door to saying religion does not have an obligation to the public good, which is dangerous. And that conversation still continues to be had.
Marcy, the court ruled that Amish parents have the right to pull the children out of school for those religious reasons. So tell us about the Amish parents that were involved in this case.
Well, it was interesting because what the Amish were arguing was that they have an agrarian society, that they need their children to be working on their farms well before high school ends. So they wanted to take the children out early high school, you know, end of middle school. And basically the argument was they have a completely different way of life and they shouldn't have to be forced to live a life where children are fully educated up through grade 12. The court dropped a footnote, which I laugh at this point, because they basically said the Amish never break the law. So in other words, this was a safe decision that letting these children not be educated would permit society to still have contributing, thriving children and adults in society. Of course, it's not true that any religious group has never had anybody arrested. And it's turned into a disaster for the children whose views were not consulted during the case. That it's hard to get a job if you leave the faith and you don't even have a high school degree.
We're talking about the legacy of Wisconsin v. Yoder as the ruling turns 50 years old. We're talking with Marcy Hamilton, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have another guest joining the conversation. Tora Bontrager is founder and executive director of the Amish Heritage Foundation. That's a nonprofit that is set up to serve Amish women and children through education. Tora, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you hear Marcy talk about the ruling itself, what is your reaction to that? Does that jibe with your experience?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Professor Hamilton is the first and so far only attorney I've run across who really, really understands Wisconsin v. Yoder inside and out and argues the case on behalf of children's rights, and not solely with the view towards advocating for parents' rights. So I love that distinction because I myself am a recipient of the decision of Yoder, a direct recipient of what happens when a child is not allowed to go to school beyond the eighth grade and receive an adequate education.
Tora, what do you want people to know about your experience?
I would like them to know that the conversation needs to be shifted towards children's rights, and that children are not objects or possessions of parents, that they are themselves individual human beings with American constitutional rights and human rights.
Now, the majority opinion in Wisconsin v. Yoder sided with Amish parents, saying that children are not mere creatures of the state. So it's interesting when I hear you say it's not just about parents, or that children aren't creatures of the parents. So supporters of that ruling would say that's a win for religious liberty, for parental education rights. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I feel it is a win for parents' rights, but it's not a win for children's rights.
Sure.
And the lower courts did side on behalf of the children's rights to education. But at the state Supreme Court level, Wisconsin State, that switched. And when it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, they upheld Wisconsin's high court ruling. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the document, you will see wording about how the children's rights aren't an issue, that this is not about the children. They're not parties to the case. And I would disagree, of course.
Right. Marcy, the Supreme Court voted unanimously, saying that an additional 1 or 2 years of high school wouldn't produce the benefits that Wisconsin law claimed. Are there other religious groups that you've seen continue to use Wisconsin v. Yoder to homeschool children?
Homeschooling has been definitely expanded and introduced, actually, because of religious groups claiming that the kids weren't getting the education they wanted in the public schools. And of course, the disaster with homeschooling around the country is that the standards aren't enforced. The states often do not track the level of education that homeschooling kids are getting. Some homeschool kids are thriving, and those are the ones we hear about, but there are a lot that aren't. But, you know, I really worry about groups like the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who routinely do not educate their boys in any of the major fields that we teach in high school, like history, science, math, English. They are teaching their boys Torah. And we can't afford a society where, especially the knowledge growth in this society is so extraordinary. We can't have a society and expect people to vote knowledgeably if they haven't had at least a high school degree.
And they're using this case that was decided 50 years ago.
That's right. They're using a case decided that long ago, but also they're using a case, the facts are radically different from how they have expanded what Yoder means for them.
We are taking calls now at 800-642-1234. And we've got Troy from Muskego on the line. Troy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Good to be here. Thank you for this program. I'm a father of four, and I'm just going to say that children are not property. And, you know, you're a steward to raise them and then prepare them for the world that they're going to live in. And it's going to be different from the world that you grew up in. So I don't understand. I think it's real selfish that these parents, based on their hangups or whatever they experienced in life, they deprive their children of learning the skills that they're going to need to survive in the world. I think it's almost borderline abuse. I really do. I don't understand it. That's all.
Troy, thank you so much for calling in. And we're going to come and talk about that more in just a moment. We've got Marcy Hamilton, who is founder and CEO of Child USA. That's a think tank dedicated to protecting kids and preventing abuse. And Tora Bontrager is founder and executive director of the Amish Heritage Foundation. We're talking about Wisconsin v. Yoder. We're going to get into the concept of parents' rights and abuse just ahead. Share your thoughts, your questions by calling 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of a U.S. Supreme Court case called Wisconsin v. Yoder. It establishes that Amish parents have the right to pull children out of school after eighth grade for religious reasons. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Our guests for this conversation are Marcy Hamilton, who leads a think tank dedicated to protecting kids and preventing abuse, and Tora Braun-Traeger, founder and executive director of the Amish Heritage Foundation. And Tora, our last caller, Troy, was concerned that this opportunity for religious extremists is borderline abuse. And you were born and raised in a traditionally Amish community, but you escaped in the middle of the night when you were 15. Tell us why you left.
I had no choice but to escape, or I felt at age 15 that my only other choice was to kill myself. That's how oppressed I was. That's the kind of abuse I experienced in my home life. Of course, not all Amish children have the same level of abusive experiences that I did, but it is, you know, corporal punishment, physical punishment is the rule of law under the Amish. So all children suffer from that. But yes, so because of Yoder, I was effectively sentenced to an undereducated life. The Supreme Court, in my view, made it criminal for me and all other children inside the Amish church to have any future outside of the church. And what was I to do? The only thing I could do was escape and hope for a better life. And so, yes, it is abuse. And some states have constitutional rights to education. Others don't. We don't have a federal constitutional right to education, which means that even for residents of states who do have education rights, any parent or guardian can say, hey, I don't think that my child should learn how to read, and I'm going to point to Yoder as a precedent, and that overrides the several or handful of states that do have explicit rights under the state constitution. So what we really need is a federal constitutional right to education to protect children, including those who wish to not necessarily give up their Amish, traditional Amish culture or other conservative groups that they're born into. But, you know, they have a protection. What they need is that to have that choice, to be given that equal level of basic education to then decide and have the means to make informed decisions for their future.
Tora, thanks for sharing your story. And Marcy, you know, Tora acknowledges that in her case, she would classify it as abuse, and that might not be the case for everyone. What about neglect? Is denying children education a form of neglect?
It is absolutely. And at Child USA, you know, we're working on the civil rights of children, and what we call this is educational neglect. And it should be criminalized. We can't have a country where our children don't fully understand that there is a constitution, that we have a proud but true history of problems, but also solutions. And, you know, I loved the caller saying that he feels like he's a steward of his children. That's right. I mean, children are not property. They were over 100 years ago. They were literal property owned by fathers who could put them into factories at will, four-year-olds at 8 a.m., but now they can't do that, and now they actually should be required to educate them to, in the best interest of the child, and not in just making the child a martyr.
Marcy, what do you say to people who argue that an eighth grade education, while it doesn't set people up for some of the different opportunities you pointed out earlier, it is a solid education where they're still able to, you know, move on and really contribute to a community?
You know, with all due respect, that era is passing behind us. The Amish children that have escaped, now Tora is a wonderful example of thriving and figuring it out and coming from the worst of circumstances to being a leader. But many who leave then try to get jobs in very low-level spots. You know, try to move up at McDonald's in management if you only have an eighth grade degree. So, and everything is getting more technical, more challenging, and more, it takes more of a knowledge base to be able to do this. But I think the crisis in democracy right now is the best example that I have of why we need to educate our children completely. We have representatives saying that there is no such thing as the separation of church and state. And that's just a result of not knowing about the Establishment Clause or about the fact that the framers believed that we needed a country that was united and diverse. So I just think it's impossible to have a thriving United States without children at least getting K through 12.
We're talking about the legacy of the Supreme Court case, Wisconsin v. Yoder, that was given 50 years ago now, talking with Marcy Hamilton and Tora Von Traeger. Tora, your organization, it aims to overturn Wisconsin v. Yoder. What's your strategy here?
The strategy is looking for the ideal candidate, which is extremely difficult. So we went down that road. There are all sorts of complexities in finding the ideal candidate. If, for one, it's difficult to find, although we did in the past few years find several. But then the process of preparing them for going through a case was too much for them. And that's understandable because when we speak of eighth grade education that the Amish have, the average Amish adult actually only has a fifth grade education when it comes to, you know, the literacy level and a third or fourth in numeracy or math. So it's really, really worse than what it sounds when you say eighth grade only. So all of this to say that we're now looking at what can we do on a legislative angle? Can we pass legislation and can we add another amendment to the Bill of Rights to make education an explicit federal right? That's where we're headed now. We feel that's more likely than finding the ideal candidate to overturn the case directly. And, Tora, and I would love to hear what Marcy's response is to that.
Yes. And I just want to clarify, Tora, when you talk about the ideal candidate, you're talking about getting somebody who would be able to be the representation and take this through the courts again to try to overturn it.
Yes, it would mm-hmm. be someone who would have would be an injured party according to the statutes. And that's just fraught with complexities because of, you know, how the legal system is arranged to sort of be a catch 22. So it essentially the way that I understand it, and Professor Hamilton can correct me if I'm wrong, but by my having successfully escaped, I was now no longer an injured party, even though the reason I had to escape was to if I wanted to go to high school or have an education beyond the eighth grade, I was forced to escape. There was no other way to do this. But the fact that I was successful now in the eyes of the legal system essentially said, well, you're not suffering academically or educationally. You made it out.
Thank you, Tora. Marcy, we've got about a minute left. What do you want to say about Wisconsin v. Yoder?
Wisconsin v. Yoder was decided in an era in which children were still treated like they were property. And it's time to move on and understand children as rights holders who have a right to thrive and to be educated. So it's my hope that we can change this through state laws. The current Supreme Court is very deferential on religious liberty, even when there's harm to others. And so, Tora, we're with you on going state to state.
Marcy, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For joining us.
Thank you.
And Tora, we really appreciate you being here this morning.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you for helping to raise visibility on this issue.
Tora Bontrager is founder and executive director of the Amish Heritage Foundation. Marcy Hamilton is founder and CEO of Child USA. That's a think tank dedicated to protecting kids and preventing abuse. Up next, we look at the science behind how and why we smile, and it's more complicated than meets the eye. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. A news update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We rely on smiles to communicate many emotions, and researchers are looking at what different smiles mean and how we interpret what they mean. Before we get into the science showing those pearly whites, let's take a moment and see if we can generate a few smiles. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum on the origin of one of Wisconsin's favorite words.
Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to cut into your regularly scheduled public radio programming. But we're here today to tell you a bit about the beloved word ope and its possible connection to the Midwest. The popularity of the word prompted a Wisconsin listener to wonder where it comes from. WPR's Andrea Anderson has more.
Diane Flaff of Hartford grew up in Wisconsin hearing and saying the word ope. It was about a year ago when someone sent her a video by comedian Charlie Behrens embracing the word and its role in the Midwest dialect.
Okay. Ope is a polite apologetic Ope is a polite apologetic exclamation expressing a sincere remorse for using oxygen on planet Earth.
Flaff had several questions about the word, so she reached out to Wisconsin Public Radio's Wisconsin for answers.
I want to know where it came from. Why do we say it all the time? And why did it all of a sudden become more popular, more well-known recently?
Flaff even did an experiment to see if people found the word to be a distraction during a conversation.
No one bats an eye. So I've tried to do it intentionally a couple of times just to see if I would get a chuckle or a look or anything. But there's nothing. Everyone just accepts it as part of our language.
To get answers to her questions, I reached out to one of public radio's favorite linguistic experts, Grant Barrett, co-host of Away With Words. And Barrett had some shocking news to share. The word ope is not specific to the Midwest. We don't own this word.
I'm sorry to take away this Midwestern thing, but you can still have the ranch dressing. We'll still give you that.
Barrett says the word is used across the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and maybe even non-English-speaking countries. So if it's that widespread, where does ope come from?
It's a physical function of the body and not a linguistic function. So what's happening is it's a little noise that you make when you suddenly stop expelling air. So it's a gentle stop. For example, you might be moving or making some kind of gesture with your hands or talking, and then you're interrupted. And you bring your exhalation of air to a sudden end, and it brings your lips together, which creates what linguists call an excrescent P.
Barrett explains excrescent in linguistics means a sound that occurs in a word without having any etymological basis. That P sound can't be traced to a French root or a Latin root or Greek root. It's created by our mouths stopping air.
In the same way that the action that we're doing is cut off, the air is cut off too. And it sounds a little like oop or ope or up.
So let's dive into another question. Is ope being used more today? Not really. Barrett says it has been used for at least 10 years and likely much longer. Some people may be seeing ope pop up more in social media thanks to memes. Barrett says they may be experiencing what's called the recency illusion. And that is when, once we notice something, we notice it more. Now, as a Midwesterner, you may be thinking, well, this is part of our identity. It's part of how we talk. And don't you know this matches our accent? There's a reason you think that.
I want to throw one more linguistic thing at you, and this is called a markedness. The tendency for a group of people to note that something is typical of them or people like them. And so that's what's happening with OPE here in Wisconsin and places like Wisconsin.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the word OPE. And this story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we are exploring the science behind smiling here on the Ideas Network. Hope that brought you a smile. Thanks for joining us. I'm Keely Boltina. When people smile, the brain sends a signal that releases feel-good neurotransmitters like dopamine and endorphins and serotonin. And we assume smiles are friendly, but people in some countries think American smiles are inauthentic and manipulative. We're talking with a Wisconsin scientist who's explored smile culture across the world for decades, and we want to hear from you. Do you smile at strangers in public? Are you someone that uses the fake smile to try to get through the day? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Paula Niedenthal, a UW-Madison psychology professor. She's the founder of the Niedenthal Emotions Lab at UW-Madison. Paula, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for your interest.
Psychologists have been paying attention to smiles carefully, but mostly from the outside. What is your UW-Madison lab learning about the smile?
We've been studying questions about smiles all the way from sort of the biology and physiology of smiling to cultural influences on smiling. So we sort of look at all sorts of levels. One of the reasons that smiles are so interesting scientifically is because although in kind of folklore or everyday knowledge, we think of smiles as reflecting the fact that somebody is happy on the inside of their body, and that if they aren't feeling happy on the inside of their body, what they're doing with their face that looks like a smile is fake. So we usually think about things as being true and fake or true and false. The world of smiles, when you sit down and think about it, even if you're not a scientist, is much more complicated than that. We smile during different states and to signal different things. So our faces are both evolutionarily and evolutionary and biological adaptations, and they're also social adjustments and adaptations and cultural products. And so we're using expressions on our face to signal what we want people to do, what we're thinking, and what we're likely to do. That's a pretty tall order for a face. But that's what we use it for. And so our lab tries to explore the different types of smiles we have and what they signal to other people, and indeed what the underlying state in the body is for the individual who's making that smile.
So smiles aren't simply the like clear expression of an internal feeling. And, you know, we've identified real smiles and fake smiles, but you're saying there are three other types of smiles that are more specific there. What have you identified?
Right. What we do is take a social functional approach to facial expression. And what that means is asking why are faces doing that in that context and that culture. And we essentially looked through the whole scientific and other literature on smiles and said, you know what, there are smiles occurring under sort of formal and important situations in which somebody's trying to solve a particular basic social task, like a task that we have to accomplish to live successfully in the world. And obviously, some people don't live that successfully in the world. And some of that can be related to smiling or how smiles come about. Looking carefully at the world of smiles and thinking about how they are functional or serve to solve social tasks, we identified a problem, which is to reward other people and ourselves. Because as you mentioned earlier, when we smile under certain conditions, we feel really good. What you can think about in terms of a task there is that We are trying to reward people and we're trying to reward ourselves. How can we do that non-verbally? A smile works really well. A smile makes us feel good about what we just did, and we're likely to repeat it. That's what happens when you get rewarded. And if we do something or somebody else does something to us that we really like and we smile at them, they're also likely to repeat that. So in terms of the previous, classification of false smiles and true smiles, this is like the true smile. This is what we think of as a true smile. We feel good or we're making somebody feel good. And what we're doing here is saying that's because we're trying to increase the probability of that behavior. But we see two other kinds of smiles that we don't call false and that seem to solve really important tasks of living. One of them we call a dominant smile. This could be also referred to as a smirk or a smug smile. This is certainly not coming from feelings of happiness, but if we wanted to use positive words, we could say pleasure in superiority. So we're usually signaling that another person has done something silly or stupid or less good than us, and that we're dominant in that situation or in that context towards them. So this does not in any way have to be associated with feelings of positivity or happiness by the smiler. And it certainly doesn't elicit positivity or happiness in the perceiver. And then finally, a smile that's probably the most frequent that one sees in the world is what we might informally call a polite smile and even possibly a fake smile. But they're very automatic and they're very functional. And so we tend to say this is a true smile of affiliation. This is a smile that we make with our lips closed at somebody as they enter an elevator or somebody that we vaguely know when we pass them on the street. And what it means is I'm safe and open. I'm safe and non-threatening in this context. So you really want to do that in an elevator, right? Because you're getting into this tiny space. And so we call that a smile of affiliation, and that signals non-threat. That's also, once again, different from feeling happy. And you're not trying to make the other person feel happy. You're trying to make them feel safe in the context. So smiles of reward, smiles of dominance, and smiles of affiliation appear to exist. We've sort of modeled how the face looks with all sorts of research. And it many, many countries identify these smiles as having meaning and as being social signals. And so we call them true smiles.
Mm. Paula Niedenthal leads smile research at UW-Madison. She's a psychology professor who created an on-campus emotions lab to study smile science. What questions do you have? Join us at 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about smile culture and why smiles are considered contagious, what they do to our bodies, what they mean. Our guest studies emotions. Paula Niedenthal is a UW-Madison psychology professor. And we were just talking a little bit about culture and how smiles translate across cultures. And we have a caller on the line who'd like to talk about this. Daniel from Madison, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
What are you wondering?
Yeah, I hear this a lot. People say American smiles are fake, and there seems to be some truth to it. You see people, especially in the store, and they smile at you. Few seconds after you look back into their faces, it's not the same. So you can tell right away that it was just to pass through the day or just the moment, or some kind of smiles are just forced on, like the customer service personnel in the store or in the offices, whether they are being forced or they've been asked to smile fakely. So they smile at you a few seconds, you look back into their face, and it's not the same anymore.
Daniel, thank you for pointing that out. Just the experience of how people's smiles might even change in the same conversation. And that really, Paula, does play into this question of social situations and how smiles differ among cultures.
Yes, I lived in France for 14 years, and I certainly heard that commentary many times. There are many comments that I've heard across the world about the possibility that this is related to capitalism and sales or manipulation. I've heard people from other cultures laugh and say, wow, if they think that that's manipulation, I mean, we smile in our culture fakely all the time. I've also heard people talking across areas of the same country. I once talked to somebody on the island of Java in Indonesia and asked about smiles on Bali, and that person said, oh, they all smile fakely there because they just want tourists to come. So this is certainly a discussion across culture, and it's in fact one of the reasons that I study smiles. It's not my impression that one country has more fake smiles than the other at all. It's just what we do have across cultures is the context in which we smile, the frequency in which we smile, and our actual need to communicate with smiles at all. So in arguing about whether a smile is false, it requires that somebody has a particular cultural lens through which they see facial expression. And if an expression doesn't occur when or as long or continuously as in their culture, they very often say that the facial expression is inauthentic. So my take on this is that there are cultural rules that lead us to accuse each other of having false smiles rather than understanding that smiles are used differently across cultures. Now, the idea that people are being forced to smile, for example, by management, that's certainly happening now in other countries. There's been smile campaigns in Russia preceding the World Cup soccer. There were smile campaigns in Paris in order to increase expressions of warmth. In these cases, and certainly there are businesses in the United States that might tell people to smile. In all of these cases, it turns out that fake smiling, if that's what it is actually more effective than scowling at people in making the interaction go smooth, at least in many countries. So first of all, the utility of a fake smile turns out in experiments to be better or higher than a true scowl or a true look of disdain. So the real question is, what are the alternatives? What are the motives? What's the culture that you're in? I remember teaching, right when I had moved from France to the United States, I taught a class on smiles, and I told my students, who were largely from the United States, what the questioner just said. And the people who worked in service jobs said, oh, wow, I'm just trying to make the people feel good. Or I chose the job because I actually like it. So I guess I think that this is a very complex question. And I think it leads to lots of cross-cultural concerns and miscommunications. And this is one of the reasons that I study smiles and culture, because I think it's a really critical and interesting problem.
We're talking about the science behind the smile with guest UW-Madison psychology professor Paula Niedenthal. And as part of the importance of the smile, we should talk about the fact that as people have been encouraged to wear masks throughout the pandemic, we have lost the ability to necessarily see a lot of the smile. You can see some of it in the eyes, but the mask covers so much of where the smile really happens. What have you found in the times where we've been asking people to cover up their smiles?
Yes, we've done research on the effects of masking smiles and other facial expressions on the perception of those expressions. And as you might guess, first of all, the crinkling of the muscles around the eye, which causes crow's feet, is involved in some smiling for some people. And it's important differentially across culture. So it's a kind of inconsistent and complex signal. But we certainly have the belief that when you smile with your eyes, you convey more positivity, at least. So given how complicated the crow's feet are, it's not a perfect signal. What is being lost is the whole bottom of the face. And the smiles that I mentioned earlier, dominance, reward, and affiliation smiles, they look somewhat different. More importantly, they have different dynamics. That is, that the way they move is different. So you do lose all of that. So you lose somewhat of ability to detect the signal, the actual meaning, like I'm telling you I'm not threatening, or I'm telling you I'm superior to you. And those are really different messages. So that's a little bit problematic. I have talked with numerous people who say, particularly in service situations or all sort of, you know, social exchange situations, that they sometimes just crinkle their eyes on purpose, even if in order to ramp up the fact that they're smiling underneath the mask, which I think is a really great and pretty fast adaptation.
Mm-hmm. If masks go away more, could we be overcompensating with our smile habits?
Do you mean because we're doing what I just described with our eyes? I guess I don't fully understand.
Yeah,
when
we take off the mask and we realize we haven't seen people's smiles, are we going to smile too much?
Oh, interesting. I suspect that we are going to go back to not smiling. I suspect that what we know, I mean, not smiling, I go back to more natural right. or baseline smiling. I suspect that once we have the full range of cues about whether the other person understands what we're doing with our face, then we don't have to increase the signal anymore. So my guess is no, that we're not going to fundamentally change.
Excellent. So that mirroring and that feedback will perhaps go back to normal. We've got Mike from Milwaukee who called and couldn't stay with us. Mike says we use emojis to communicate our smiles through technology. So do we need more emojis to express our different smiles?
We have millions of them, and we actually do have all of those to some degree. But, you know, as we see, just like with language and also with facial expressions across cultures, like there has to be convergent agreement or norms adopted for how the emoji matches what we're trying to communicate. So, you know, designers don't necessarily look at my research of the emojis. And so they're probably approximating what they know to be true in the world. And so what they know to be true in the world will turn out to have affiliation and dominance and reward smiles. But people probably, you know, will need some work on converging on what those mean. So we probably don't need more. We need more agreement.
Mm, so that kind of, as we talked about smiling in real life across cultures, doing that in the digital realm.
Right.
Hmm. Paula, this has been fascinating. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about smiling.
Absolutely. I really appreciate your interest, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Paula Niedenthal is a UW-Madison psychology professor. She is the founder of the Niedenthal Emotions Lab at UW-Madison. And we've been talking about smiles. You can continue the conversation if you like. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings if you'd like to share your smile or talk more about what smiling means to you or different situations where you've had questions or interesting interactions with people. And you find yourself smiling. Maybe it's, you know, while you're streaming things and you smile back at the TV and you find yourself doing that. Not that I would have experienced that. Ahead on the morning show, thanks for staying with us. We welcome former Senator Russ Feingold and scholar Peter Prindeville. We're talking about their new book. It's about the potential for a constitutional convention and how they see the extreme right trying to redefine America. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. Join us for that conversation next. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.